presented by Apple News.
Annals of Inquiry, published in the print issue of The New Yorker with the headline, Phantasma. Some people can see mental images. Some can't. The consequences are profound. Written by Larissa McFarquhar. Narrated by Winsome Brown. Produced by Apple News. Please be advised, this article contains adult language. When Nick Watkins was a child, he pasted articles about space exploration into scrapbooks and drew annotated diagrams of rockets. He knew this because, years later, he still had the scrapbooks and took them to be evidence that he had been a happy child, although he didn't remember making them. When he was 7 in the summer of 1969, his father woke him up to watch the moon landing. It was in the middle of the night where they lived near Southampton in England. He didn't remember this either, but he'd been told that it happened. That Christmas, he and his brother were given matching space helmets. He knew that on Christmas morning, the helmets had been waiting in the kitchen and that, on discovering his, he felt joy. But this was not a memory, exactly. The knowledge seemed to him more personal than an ordinary fact, but he could not feel or picture what it had been like to be that boy in the kitchen. When he was 8 or 9, he read Arthur C. Clarke's novel 2001, A Space Odyssey, over and over. At the beginning of the book, aliens implant images of tool using into the minds of man-apes. Near the end, the main character, David Bowman, spools backward through memories of his life. Not only vision, but all the sense impressions and all the emotions he had felt at the time were racing past, more and more swiftly. His life was unreeling like a tape recorder playing back at ever-increasing speed. Faces he had once loved and had thought lost beyond recall smiled at him. To Nick, these events, the images in the mind of the man-apes, David Bowman's reliving of his life, were thrilling and otherworldly, with no connection to reality, brought about through the intervention of aliens in distant fictional worlds. He became a physicist. He was drawn to statistical physics and quantum mechanics, whose concepts were best described in equations. The abstraction of these ideas suited him. One morning in 1997, when he was 35, he was sitting at breakfast, paging through the newspaper. He started to read an article by a columnist he admired, Michael Bywater. Time was an illusion, Bywater wrote, because you could roll it backward and relive it. You choose a memory, focus on it, let the rest of the mind go blank, and wait. Bywater described particular memories of his own, not only the sight, but the sound and feel of them, the special weight of girls in autumn when they lean against you as you walk along. For some reason, these sentences revealed all at once to Nick what in the whole course of his life he had not realized, that it was possible to see pictures in your mind and use those pictures to re-experience your past. This was startling information. He knew, of course, that people talked about picturing or visualizing, but he had always taken this to be just a metaphorical way of saying thinking. Now it appeared that in some incomprehensible sense, people meant these words literally. And then there was the notion of using those mental images to revisit a memory. It was an astonishing idea. Was it possible that this was a thing that people other than Bywater could do? Bywater had written about it quite casually, as though he took it for granted. Nick asked some people he knew, and all of them seemed to be able to do it. He wondered whether there was something wrong with him, some kind of amnesia. He'd had no reason to worry about his memory before. He had a PhD in physics. Clearly his mind was functioning reasonably well. He knew the usual facts about his life, his parentage, the places he'd lived as a child, important things that had happened. It had never occurred to him that remembering could be more than that. For many years, Nick would search for information about mental imagery, sporadically and alone. In the beginning, he did not yet know that his inability to visualize this odd feature of his mind which appeared so insignificant that he hadn't even noticed it for 35 years, would come to seem a central wellspring of his self. But then, in 2015, his condition was given a scientific name, aphantasia, and tens of thousands of people experienced the same shocked realization that he had. A flurry of research in the following decade would uncover associations between mental imagery and a bewildering variety of human traits and capacities, a propensity to hold grudges, autism, a vulnerability to trauma, emotional awareness, ways of making art and hearing music, memory of one's life. But this was all in the future. In 1997, as much as he interrogated his acquaintances, Nick did not find anyone like him. He couldn't be the only person who lacked this ability to visualize, he thought. Surely it was extremely unlikely that he was unique. But until he encountered someone else, he had to admit that it was a working possibility. He went online and started looking. Initially, he found only work from the 19th century. The first useful thing he came across was William James's book, Principles of Psychology. James referred to observations recorded in 1860 by Gustav Fechner, a German scientist and philosopher. Fechner had subjected his own optical memory pictures to introspective scrutiny and deemed them weak and lacking. With all my efforts, I cannot reproduce colors in the memory images of colored objects. I also never dream in colors, but all my experiences in dreams seem to me to proceed in a kind of twilight or night. I can't hold the image steadily for even a short time, but in order to observe it for a longer time, I have to recreate it again and again. What was very unexpected to me is that it is easier for me to produce memory images with open eyes than with closed eyes. Fechner didn't pursue the subject, however, and it lay dormant until 1880, when it was taken up by Francis Galton, a British scientist who later became notorious as the father of eugenics. Galton, supposing that he could depend on scientists to give accurate answers, wrote to several of them with a query. Think of some definite object, suppose it is your breakfast table as you sat down to it this morning, and consider carefully the picture that rises before your mind's eye. Is the image dim or fairly clear? Are the colors of the china, of the toast, bread crust, mustard, meat, parsley, or whatever may have been on the table, quite distinct and natural? The responses he received were not at all what he had expected. To my astonishment, I found that the great majority of the men of science to whom I first applied protested that mental imagery was unknown to them, and they looked on me as fanciful and fantastic in supposing that the words mental imagery really expressed what I believed everybody to suppose them to mean. They had a mental deficiency of which they were unaware, and naturally enough supposed that those who were normally endowed were romancing. Finding this Galton study came as a relief to Nick. Now, at least he knew that there had been other people lacking mental imagery who'd lived normal lives, so it wasn't a disease or a symptom of a brain tumor. Galton had subsequently observed that women and children appeared to have more vivid imagery than the scientists did. Scientific men as a class, he concluded, have feeble powers of visual representation. Nick found this intriguing. Perhaps his own lack of imagery had somehow enhanced his scientific ability. He knew that there was, among some mathematicians, a kind of snobbery about images, a notion that even in geometry, drawings were distractions from a purely analytical proof. But he also knew that there were any number of legends in the history of science of visions leading to discoveries. Einstein had visualized himself traveling alongside a beam of light, and this had led to his conception of relativity. The best-known instance that Nick was aware of was the German chemist August Kekulé, to whom the structure of the benzene ring had appeared in a dream. Long rows, all twining and twisting in snake-like motion. One of the snakes had seized hold of its own tail, and the form whirled mockingly before my eyes. As if by a flash of lightning, I awoke and spent the rest of the night in working out the consequences of the hypothesis. At one point, Nick came across a paper from 1909 that stressed the importance of distinguishing between voluntary imagery, the ability to call up mental pictures at will, and involuntary imagery. Sometimes people who couldn't call up images on purpose did experience them involuntarily, usually during migraines or high hallucinatory fevers or in dreams, or the hypnagogic state just before sleep. This caught his attention because he was almost certain that he saw images in dreams, although he couldn't be sure since nothing remained of the images after he woke. If he was right, and he did see images in sleep, then it was strange that he couldn't summon them at other times. Was he repressing them? When he searched for scientific studies on imagery in the mid-20th century, he found very little. It seemed that the study of imagery had largely disappeared from scientific research from the 1920s to the 50s, owing in part to the dominance of behaviorism in America, which condemned inquiry into internal psychological states as unscientific. J.B. Watson, behaviorism's founder, repudiated the existence of mental imagery altogether. What does a person mean when he closes his eyes or ears, figuratively speaking, and says, "I see the house where I was born, the trundle bed in my mother's room where I used to sleep. I can even see my mother as she comes to tuck me in, and I can even hear her voice as she softly says goodnight." Touching, of course, but sheer bunk. We are merely dramatizing. The behaviorist finds no proof of imagery at all in this. Later, researchers would debate whether Watson became a behaviorist because he had no internal imagery, or whether he actually had strong imagery but denied it because of ideological blindness. In the 1970s, Nick discovered, a few psychologists liberated from mid-century behaviorist orthodoxy had begun to explore imagery again. A British psychologist named David Marks, for instance, developed the Vividness of Visual Imagery questionnaire, which sought to measure a person's ability to picture not only a stationary object, but also movement, the characteristic gait of a familiar person, change, the shifting color of the sky at sunrise, and degree of detail, the window of a shop you frequently go to. But the psychologists in the 1970s were interested in people with typical imagery. When Nick searched for studies on people like himself, he found nothing. Sometime in the early 2000s, Jim Campbell, a Scottish surveyor in his mid-60s, made an appointment with a neurologist at the University of Edinburgh named Adam Zeman. Jim had recently had a cardiac procedure, and afterward, he'd noticed that he could no longer picture anything in his head. Before the surgery, he used to put himself to sleep by visualizing his children and grandchildren. Now, he couldn't see anything at all. Zeman had a general neurology practice, Parkinson's, MS, dementia, but he had also been interested in consciousness since he was a student. He speculated that one of the things that made humans different from other primates was their ability to mentally project themselves into the past or future, or into worlds that were purely imaginary. So he was fascinated to encounter in Jim a syndrome he had never heard of before, which appeared to be an excision of just this species-defining ability. And yet Jim was clearly very much a human, wry, reserved, down to earth. His neurological, psychiatric, and cognitive tests were all normal. If Jim had not described his condition, Zeman would not have known there was anything unusual about him. Even questions designed to evoke imagery, which is darker, grass or pine needles, do squirrels have long or short tails, Jim answered without hesitation. When Zeman asked him how he could answer without picturing these things, he said that he just knew. Zeman searched for recent scientific papers that could shed light on this strange condition, but was unable to find anything useful. The case reminded him of blindsight, a rare phenomenon in which people who can't see behave as though they can, picking up objects and avoiding obstacles. Their eyes and brains can take in visual information, but the information doesn't rise to consciousness. Zeman felt that Jim was not the sort of person who would make something like this up, but he wanted proof that his brain was functioning in an unusual manner. He recruited a control group of men of similar age and put them and Jim through cognitive tests in an MRI scanner. Here, he found the neurological correlate that he was looking for. Although Jim's brain responded normally to tests of recognition, being shown images of famous faces, when he was asked to generate a mental image, the scanner showed only faint brain activity compared with the brain activity in the control group. Instead, there was activation in areas of the frontal lobe that were typically activated in situations of cognitive effort or dissonance. Jim was trying, but failing. In 2010, Zeman, along with several colleagues, published these findings in the journal Neuropsychologia, terming the syndrome blind imagination. The science journalist Carl Zimmer noticed the study and wrote an article about it in Discover magazine. In the years that followed, a couple of dozen people contacted Zeman to tell him that they had the same condition, except they'd had it since birth. Zeman sent them questionnaires and tabulated their answers. At this point, he decided that lack of mental imagery was a valid syndrome that ought to have a name. After consulting with a classicist friend, he decided on aphantasia, phantasia being defined by Aristotle as the ability to conjure an image in the imagination. In 2015, Zeman co-wrote a paper in Cortex describing the condition as it appeared in 21 subjects. Lives without imagery, congenital aphantasia. An article about Zeman's second paper appeared in the New York Times, and after that, emails poured in. Around 17,000 people contacted him. Most were congenital aphantasics, and most not only lacked visual imagery, they could not mentally call up sounds either, or touch, or the sensation of movement. Many had difficulty recognizing faces. Many said that they had a family member who was aphantasic too. Most said that they saw images in dreams. Zeman recruited colleagues to work with him, and together they tried to reply to every correspondent. Some people who wrote had once had imagery, but lost it. About half of these had lost it as a consequence of physical injury, stroke, meningitis, head trauma, suffocation. The other half attributed their loss to a psychiatric cause, depersonalization syndrome, depression. A few told him that they thought they'd suppressed their capacity to visualize because traumatic memories had made imagery intolerable. Zeman learned that there had been a case in 1883 described by the French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot in which a man, Monsieur X, had lost his imagery. At the same time, the world suddenly appeared alien to him and he became intensely anxious. I observed a drastic change in my existence that obviously mirrored a remarkable change in my personality, Monsieur X wrote to Charcot. Before, I used to be emotional, enthusiastic with a prolific imagination. Today I am calm, cold, and I lost my imagination. Another 19th century French neurologist, Jules Cotard, described a patient whose loss of mental imagery was accompanied by what became known as Cotard's delusion, or walking corpse syndrome, the belief that he was dead. Zeman also received messages from people who appeared to have the opposite of aphantasia. They told him that their mental pictures were graphic and inescapable. There was evidently a spectrum of mental imagery, with aphantasia on one end and extraordinarily vivid imagery on the other, and most people's experience somewhere in between. Zeman figured that the vivid extreme needed a name as well. He dubbed it hyperphantasia. It seemed that 2 or 3% of people were aphantasic and somewhat more were hyperphantasic. Many of his correspondents, he learned, had discovered their condition very recently, after reading about it or hearing it described on the radio. Their whole lives, they had heard people talk about picturing and imagining and counting sheep and visualizing beaches and seeing in the mind's eye, and assumed that all those idioms were only metaphors or colourful hyperbole. It was amazing how profoundly people could misunderstand one another and assume that others didn't mean what they were saying, how minds could wrest sense out of things that made no sense. Some said they had a tantalizing feeling that images were somewhere in their minds, only just out of reach, like a word on the tip of their tongue. This sounded right to Zeeman. The images must be stored in some way, since aphantasics were able to recognize things. In fact, it seemed that most aphantasics weren't hampered in their everyday functioning. They had good memories for facts and tasks. But many of them said that they remembered very little about their own lives. Among the emails that Zeeman received, there were, to his surprise, several from aphantasic professional artists. One of these was Sherry Paisley, at the time Sherry Bakes, a painter in her 40s who lived in Vancouver. When Sherry was young, she'd had imagery so vivid that she sometimes had difficulty distinguishing it from what was real. She painted intricate likenesses of people and animals. Portraiture attracted her because she was interested in psychology. Then, when she was 29, she had a stroke and lost her imagery altogether. To her, the loss of imagery was a catastrophe. She felt as though her mind were a library that had burned down. She no longer saw herself as a person. Gradually, as she recovered from her stroke, she made her way back to painting, working very slowly. She switched from acrylic paints to oils because acrylics dried too fast. She found that her art had drastically changed. She no longer wanted to paint figuratively. She painted abstractions that looked like galaxies seen through a space telescope. She lost interest in psychology. She wanted to connect to the foundations of the universe. Years later, she remembered that one night at her parents' house when she was still in art school, she had stayed up very late painting. She suddenly felt a strong presence behind her, and even as she kept working, she felt the presence ask her, "What do you want?" In her thoughts, she responded, "I want to be a great painter, and I will do whatever I have to, except take drugs." Later she thought, "Well, that is what happened. My life is very hard, but my painting is so much better." Sherry had been an artist before she lost her imagery, but there were others who had been aphantasic for as long as they could remember. Isabel Nolan, a well-known Irish artist, had recently discovered in her 40s, while reading about Zeeman's work in New Scientist, that other people could see pictures in their heads. There was an element of, like, fuck, is the only way I can put it. Horrified and cheated. I still feel a bit cheated. She wondered whether she had always been like this. When she was a child, her mother would occasionally go on business trips, and while she was away, Isabel stayed with cousins who lived up the road. She remembered lying in bed one night at her cousin's house thinking, "What if Mam dies? I can't remember what she looks like." She was an anxious child, frightened of many things, but this particular thought stuck in her mind for years. Now she wondered how she could have been so upset at the thought that she couldn't picture her mother unless she'd had a notion, some vestigial memory, that such a thing was possible. Her fear of things vanishing had not gone away. In fact, it had expanded from her mother to everything. She had lived in Dublin almost all her life, although it would probably have been better for her career if she'd moved to London. As it turned out, it hadn't held her back. She would be representing Ireland in the Venice Biennale in 2026. But when she was younger, she'd wondered if she was making a mistake. She thought that maybe she'd stayed because having the physical infrastructure of her past around helped her to remember it. For a long time, she felt that everything around her was ephemeral, precarious, not to be relied on. I was putting together a book in 2020, gathering about 9 years of work and writing, and there was an awful lot of writing alluding to the fact of barely having a grasp on the world and how slippery it all is. I realized that my inability to recall things was really playing on my mind, and that my connection to my social world felt insubstantial. I wrote a lot about how touch was important to me and how making work was setting down little anchors that reminded me that the world does exist. Surely this had something to do with not being able to picture anything when she wasn't looking at it. The world does disappear completely when you close your eyes. At a conference, she heard artists with vivid imagery say that they were often disappointed by their work because it could never match up to the glowing vision in their heads. She felt sorry for them. When she was working on something, she never knew how it would end up. Sometimes she started with an idea, like the cosmos. She liked to look at images of deep space and draw abstractions that resembled them. She thought a lot about subjective experience, but not her own experience in particular, more what it was like to be any human, wandering through the world. She didn't feel that her work was an extension or expression of herself, so she didn't mind criticism or not being understood. I don't think I have a very strong sense of self, and it's not something I'm super interested in. Was this because of her aphantasia? If her mind were filled with pictures, would herself feel fuller, more robust? When people learned that they were aphantasic, they tended to wonder whether this or that aspect of themselves was due to their lack of imagery. Sometimes it had nothing to do with it, but in this case it did. Several studies had found that people with vivid imagery tended to be more inward, absorbed in the drift of their own minds. Someone had told Isabel about a British moral philosopher, Derek Parfit, who had no imagery. He had few memories and little connection to his past, although he felt strong emotions about people and ideas in the present. Parfit believed that a self was not a unique, distinct thing, but a collection of shifting memories and thoughts, which intersected with the memories and thoughts of others. Ultimately, he thought, selves were not important. What mattered was the moral imperatives that drove everyone, or ought to, preventing suffering, the future welfare of humanity, the search for truth. Isabel, like Parfit, remembered very little about her life. She kept boxes of souvenirs, ticket stubs, programs, but unless she looked at these things, or a friend reminded her, she didn't recall most of the places she'd visited or things she'd done. She imagined that this could be a problem in a relationship. If you didn't remember what you'd done together and the other person got upset and accused you of not caring, though fortunately, she'd never been with someone like that. When she went out with friends who were full of stories, she'd worry that she wasn't entertaining enough. Normally, she drew people out and got them talking so she didn't have to. I don't really have a sense with some friends how well I know them. I've kind of forgotten. They'd be like, oh yeah, do you remember we went to the play that night? And sometimes I'd just pretend. I'd be like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I think when my relationships are continuous, it's much easier. You remember more because you're constantly re-exercising the memories of stuff that you did together. You know, the time we went to Cologne and got hammered and lost our cameras, blah, blah, blah. It would be nice to remember all the funny stories that people told. But in the end, she didn't mind too much. She could just sit there and bask in the pleasure of being with old friends. It was the feeling that was important. She didn't need to know what had happened years ago. In some ways, this made things easier. She mostly didn't remember arguments or bad feelings. She hoped that the significant moments in her life, good and bad, had left their imprint on her in some way, but it was impossible to know. I feel like my past is kind of imaginary. I know what happened, but it doesn't feel like, I don't know. It's hard to know what having experiences means, because sometimes experiences that I have can leave one so quickly. One can feel a little disconnected from your own past. Claire Dewdney was an artist who worked in southeast London, in a warren of old factory buildings by the Thames. Against one wall of her studio was a wooden loom, above which large spools of cotton thread in a rainbow of colours were slotted on pegs. She made works in many media, all cornucopias of colour, pieces of fabric dyed robin's egg blue or pistachio or hazelnut or citrine, and pasted into collages, some so long that you couldn't take them in at once, and hung near open doors so that they rippled. She made murals of ceramic tiles painted with irregular shapes, like countries on a map, in powder puff pink and celery and yellow and wheat. Rectangular blocks of rough wood that she called woodcut paintings, with teal, red, cornflower and lime pigment staining or filling the crevices and gouges of the surface. Long clay worms, basket woven and glazed, forest, mustard, chestnut, like ceramic macrame. She draped herself in colours too, thick scarves and nubby sweaters that she knitted herself, geometric patterned skirts. In talking to a friend of hers, an aphantasic painter who was one of Zeman's research subjects, Claire had realised that she was the opposite, hyperphantasic. Her imagery was extraordinarily vivid. There was always so much going on inside her head, her mind skittering and careening about, that it was difficult to focus on what or who was actually in front of her. There were so many pictures and flashes of memory and glimpses of things she had thought were memory but wasn't sure, and scenarios, real and imaginary, and schemes and speculations and notions and plans, a relentless flood of images and ideas continuously coursing through her mind. It was hard to get to sleep. At one point, in an effort to slow the flood, she tried meditation. She went on a 10-day silent retreat, but she disliked it so much, too many rules, getting up far too early, that she rebelled. While sitting in a room with no pictures or stimulation of any kind, supposedly meditating, she decided to watch the first Harry Potter movie in her head. She wasn't able to recall all 2 hours of it, but watching what she remembered lasted for 45 minutes. Then she did the same with the other 7 films. She tried not to expose herself to ugly or violent images because she knew they would stick in her mind for years. But even without a picture, if she even heard about violence, her mind would produce one. Once, reading about someone undergoing surgery without anesthetic, she imagined it so graphically that she fainted. In 2012, 2 Harvard psychologists published a study about visual imagery and moral judgment. They found that people with weak imagery tended to think more abstractly about moral questions and believe that good ends sometimes justified harmful means. But for people with strong imagery, the harmful means, injuries done to one person in order to save several others, say, formed such lurid pictures in their minds that they responded emotionally and rejected them. Even joyful images could turn on her. She'd had a cat that she loved. She was separated from her husband and living on her own, so she had spent more time with the cat than with any other creature. Then the cat died, and after his death, she saw him everywhere, on the sofa, on the floor, on her bed, wherever he had been in life. She saw him so clearly that it was as though he were actually there in front of her. Her grief was made so much worse by this relentless haunting that she began to feel as if she would not be able to cope. Her father was a physicist and for many years the deputy director of the British Antarctic Survey. When Claire was a child, he promised that one day he would take her to Antarctica. And finally, when she was in her 30s in 2013, he did. There on the boat, she found herself looking at a landscape so wholly unfamiliar that her brain struggled to make sense of it. At times, it barely appeared to her like a landscape at all, more like an abstract surface without reference or meaning. The place was vast, and there were no people. Snow and ice formed strange patterns on the surface of the sea. As they travelled, the terrain kept changing, so her sense of alien newness persisted. It was as if, for the first time, she was seeing not through the cluttered, obscuring scrim of her visual memories, but directly, at the world itself. Just looking at it was so demanding that it occupied her whole mind, so that she wasn't thinking about anything else. She was just there. At the time, she was consulting on climate and sustainability issues, but after that trip, she decided to become an artist. Usually her ideas for artworks came not from anything external, but from images in her head. For a while she had made paintings based on her dreams. She kept a journal and a pen by the side of her bed so that she could describe what she dreamed the moment she woke. The more she wrote down her dreams, the more she remembered them. Sometimes she would remember 10 dreams in a single night. Eventually the process began to fold in on itself. While she was still asleep, she'd begin to dream that she was taking notes on the dream and planning how to draw what she saw. When she thought about making a new piece, she often worked it out in her mind beforehand. Being hyperphantasic didn't mean only that your imagery was bright and sharp. It meant that you could manipulate your images at will, zooming in and out, cutting and pasting, flipping and mirroring, creating pictures from scratch, assembling and disassembling complicated objects. Even when she was trying to evoke the colors of a landscape at a certain time of day, she did it not from life, but from memory. She didn't know how common this was among artists, but there were some who she was fairly sure had worked from their imaginations rather than from life. J.M.W. Turner, for instance, made rough sketches outdoors, but the seas and skies and light of his paintings all came from his head. There was an English portraitist working in the late 18th century whose prodigious powers of visualization had been described in a case study. The study didn't name the painter, but said that he'd inherited most of the clients of Sir Joshua Reynolds after Reynolds's death, and had proceeded to take full advantage of this by painting 300 portraits in a single year. The study's author, a British physician named A.L. Wiggin, reported, "This would seem physically impossible, but the secret of his rapidity and of his astonishing success was this. He required but one sitting and painted with miraculous facility. I myself saw him execute a Kit Kat portrait of a gentleman, well known to me, in little more than 8 hours. It was minutely finished and a most striking likeness. On asking him to explain it, he said, 'When a sitter came, I looked at him attentively for half an hour, sketching from time to time on the canvas. I wanted no more. I put away my canvas and took another sitter. When I wished to resume my first portrait, I took the man and set him in the chair, where I saw him as distinctly as if he had been before me in his own proper person. I may almost say more vividly. I looked from time to time at the imaginary figure, then worked with my pencil, then referred to the countenance, and so on, just as I should have done had the sitter been there. When I looked at the chair, I saw the man.'" The painter's imagery was so lifelike, however, that he began to confuse his mind's pictures with reality and succumbed to a mental illness that lasted 30 years. Hyperphantasia often seemed to function as an emotional amplifier in mental illness, heightening hypomania, worsening depression, causing intrusive traumatic imagery and PTSD to be more realistic and disturbing. Rayshan Reeder, a neuroscientist at the University of Liverpool, began interviewing hyperphantasics in 2021 and found that many of them had a fantasy world that they could enter at will. But they were also prone to what she called maladaptive daydreaming. They might become so absorbed while on a walk that they would wander, not noticing their surroundings, and get lost. It was difficult for them to control their imaginations. Once they pictured something, it was hard to get rid of it. It was so easy for hyperphantasics to imagine scenes as lifelike as reality that they could later become unsure what had actually happened and what had not. "I can imagine my hand burning to the point where it's painful. I've always been curious, if they put me in an fMRI, would that show up? That's one of the biggest problems in my life. When I feel something, is it real?" One hyperphantasic told a researcher that he had more than once walked into a wall because he had pictured a doorway. Because their imaginative lives were so compelling, hyperphantasics tended to be inwardly focused. This could mean that they were detached from reality, living in the remembered past and the imaginary future, rather than in the actual present. But it could also mean that they were hyper-aware of their internal reality, tuned in to the cues of their bodies and the shifts in their emotions. Some researchers hypothesized that the heightened awareness of these bodily and emotional signals were one reason that people with vivid imagery usually had strong memories of their pasts. These signals somehow helped to anchor memories to the self. Hyperphantasics memories could be exceptionally detailed. Someone might mention something like, "Did you ever skateboard as a kid?" And then I have to watch out for the avalanche of every skateboarding experience I ever had. It's like being in virtual reality and having a 360-degree video of 1,000 skateboarding experiences at the same time. Memories might take on quasi-physical forms in their minds. They might picture sheaves of recollections or files of information sitting on shelves in a mental warehouse. They might envision lists of facts about a particular place pinned to that place on a vast and detailed mental map that they saw spread out before them like a hologram. Reeder had tested children's imagery and believed that most children were hyperphantasic. They had not yet undergone the synaptic pruning that took place in adolescence, so there were incalculably more neuronal connections linking different parts of their brain, giving rise to fertile imagery. Then, as they grew older, the weaker connections were pruned away. Because the synapses that were pruned tended to be the ones that were used less, Reeder thought that it was possible that the children who grew up to be hyperphantasic adults were those who kept on wanting to conjure up visual fantasy worlds, even as they grew older. Conversely, perhaps children who grew up to become typical imagers daydreamed less and less, becoming more interested in the real people and things around them. Maybe some children who loved to daydream were scolded, in school or at home, to pay attention. And maybe these children disciplined themselves to focus on the here and now and lost the ability to travel to the imaginary worlds they'd known when they were young. Claire had not been discouraged from daydreaming as a child, and she had preferred it to the other common form of imaginative dissociation, reading. Daydreaming was more pleasurable for her because she had struggled to learn to read, and even once she knew how, she'd found it slow going. When she received a diagnosis of dyslexia as an adult, the tester told her that rather than processing individual letters or sounds, she was memorizing pictures of whole words, which made it hard to recognize words in different fonts. Her visual sense was so overweening that reading was strenuous because she was easily distracted by the squiggles and lines of the text. Naturally, aphantasics usually had a very different experience of reading. Like most people, as they became absorbed, they stopped noticing the visual qualities of the words on the page, and because their eyes were fully employed in reading, they also stopped noticing the visual world around them. But because the words prompted no mental images, it was almost as if reading bypassed the visual world altogether and tunneled directly into their minds. Aphantasics might skip over descriptive passages in books, since description aroused no images in their minds, they found it dull, or because of such passages, avoid fiction altogether. Some aphantasics found the movie versions of novels more compelling, since these supplied the pictures that they were unable to imagine. Of course, for people who did have imagery, seeing a book character in a movie was often unsettling, because they already had a sharp mental image of the character, which didn't look like the actor, or because their image was vague, but just particular enough that the actor looked wrong. Or because their image was barely there at all, and the physical solidity of the actor conflicted with that amorphousness. Presumably, novelists who invented characters also had a variety of responses to seeing them instantiated in solid form. Jane Austen wrote a letter to her sister in 1813 in which she described going to an exhibition of paintings in London and searching for portraits that looked like Elizabeth Bennet and Jane Bingley, two main characters from Pride and Prejudice. To her delight, she'd seen a small portrait of Mrs. Bingley, excessively like her, exactly herself, size, shaped face, features and sweetness. There never was a greater likeness. She is dressed in a white gown with green ornaments, which convinces me of what I had always supposed, that green was a favourite colour with her. Austen did not see Elizabeth at the exhibition, but hoped, she told her sister, to find a painting of her somewhere in the future. "I dare say Mrs. D," she wrote, Darcy being Elizabeth's married name, "will be in yellow." One of the 20 or so congenital aphantasics who contacted Adam Zeman after his original 2010 paper was a Canadian man in his 20s, Tom Ibayer. Ibayer volunteered to participate in Zeman's studies, and after Zeman published his 2015 Cortex paper on congenital aphantasia, Ibayer was one of the participants quoted in the Times article about it. After that, hundreds of aphantasics reached out to him on Facebook and LinkedIn. They asked him questions that he didn't know the answers to. Does this mean I have a disability? Is there a cure? Many of Ibayer's correspondents felt shocked and isolated, as he had. He decided that what was needed was an online forum where aphantasics could go for information and community. He set up a website, the Aphantasia Network. He didn't want it to be a sad place where people commiserated with one another, however. There were good things about aphantasia, he believed, and he began to write uplifting posts, pointing them out. In one, he argued that aphantasia was an advantage in abstract thinking. When prompted by the word horse, a person with imagery would likely picture a particular horse, one they'd seen in life, perhaps, or in a painting. An aphantasic, on the other hand, focused on the concept of a horse, on the abstract essence of horseness. Ibayer published posts about famous people who had realized that they were aphantasic. Glenn Keane, one of the leading Disney animators on The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. John Green, the author of The Fault in Our Stars, whose books had sold more than 50 million copies. J. Craig Venter, the biologist who led the first team to sequence the human genome. Blake Ross, who co-created the Mozilla Firefox web browser when he was 19. Ibayer also wanted the Aphantasia Network to be a place where aphantasics could find recent scientific research. For instance, estimating the strength of a person's imagery had been thoroughly subjective until Joel Pearson, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of New South Wales in Australia, devised tests to measure it more precisely. In a paper from 2022, Pearson reported that when people with imagery visualized a bright object, their pupils contracted, as though they were seeing a bright object in real life. But the pupils of aphantasics imagining a bright object stayed the same. Another study of his had shown that although aphantasics had the same fear response, sweating, as typical imagers to a frightening image shown on a screen, when exposed to a frightening story, they barely responded at all. Ibayer kept in touch with Zeman and published bulletins about his research. Zeman had found that aphantasics could solve many problems that would seem to require imagery, such as counting the number of windows in their home. This, Zeman hypothesized, was due to the difference between object imagery and spatial imagery. There were two streams of visual information in the brain that were, to a surprising degree, distinct from each other. One had to do with recognition of objects, the other with guiding action through space. Aphantasics lacked object imagery, but they might have the kind of spatial imagery that would enable them to count windows. One aphantasic described his ability to do this as a kind of echolocation. To Zeman, one of the most tantalizing promises of the study of mental imagery was the light it might shed on the neural correlates of consciousness. Connectivity in the brain seemed to be particularly important in both consciousness and aphantasia. fMRI studies had shown reduced connectivity in aphantasics, and Brian Levine, a neuropsychologist at the Baycrest Academy for Research and Education in Toronto, had found that connectivity between the memory system and the visual perceptual regions in the brain correlated to how well people remembered their lives. Many of the aphantasics who had written to Zeman identified themselves as autistic. Autism was thought to be a state of reduced long-range connectivity in the brain, so Zeman theorized that there could be a link. But autism had also been associated with thinking in pictures. Temple Grandin, for instance, the autistic writer and professor of animal science, described her autism that way. So clearly the link was not a simple one. After creating the Aphantasia Network, Ebayer received tens of thousands of messages from all over the world, Korea, Venezuela, Madagascar. He launched Aphantasia Network Japan and made plans for a Spanish language site. When the city of Rowlett, a suburb of Dallas, declared the world's first Aphantasia Awareness Day on February 21, 2023, his site published a celebratory post. Once hyperphantasia began to be written about, he started to hear from hyperphantasics as well. When he wrote a post about how some people could hear music in their heads or relive touch or tastes, most responses were from aphantasics amazed to learn that such things were possible. But one person wrote to him describing a kind of auditory hyperphantasia. "I can, and do, listen to entire classical works in my head. The longest continuous one was the entire Verdi Requiem, listened to internally on a long-haul flight. The imagery is very detailed. I can summon up a work and identify the instruments playing in an orchestral texture or the registration being used in a particular organ piece. I can't turn it off, though. It's in the background as I write, Schumann, Third Symphony, last movement. Sometimes a short passage will repeat endlessly, typically when I'm stressed. And if I wake at night, it is usually with a short sequence of harmonies repeating themselves." This past January, Zeman and others published a short article in Cortex clarifying that the definition of aphantasia encompassed people with weak imagery. Ebayer wrote a post in response, wondering whether this inclusive definition risked diluting the experiences of those with total aphantasia, such as himself. Might it threaten the cohesion of the aphantasia community? Aphantasia at this point wasn't only a syndrome, after all. It was an identity. In the course of his quest to learn about imagery, Nick Watkins, the physicist, came across an essay by Oliver Sacks. Sacks mentioned that he normally had almost no mental imagery, but that during a 2-week period in his 30s when he'd been downing heroic quantities of amphetamines, he'd suddenly been able to retain images in his mind, though only images of things that he had just looked at. During that time, he also found it much more difficult to think in abstractions. When the drugs wore off, the images dissipated and his abstract thinking returned. This was an auspicious discovery, Nick thought, that you could somehow turn imagery on. He was certainly not going to take amphetamines himself. He was a pretty cautious person, especially if doing so might jeopardize his ability to think abstractly. But if amphetamines could work, maybe something else could too. He kept looking. He discovered that Aldous Huxley was aphantasic and that in The Doors of Perception, he had written that he was expecting mescaline to change this, even if only for a few hours. It didn't. Unsurprisingly, amid the recent research on psychedelics, this hope of arousing mental vision with drugs had been revived. In 2018, the Journal of Psychedelic Studies published a paper about an aphantasic man, S.E., who had taken ayahuasca and had an intensely emotional experience of visualizing and then forgiving his father, long dead, who had left him when he was very young. Afterward, S.E. was still able to see images, but only faintly. He and the paper's authors concluded that his aphantasia had likely been psychological in origin, since it was resolved by his feeling that things between him and his father had been settled. Another paper, published in the same journal in 2025, described an autistic aphantasic woman in her mid-30s who had eaten psilocybin truffles and experienced mental imagery for the first time. Her imagery persisted for many months, although it was not quite as vivid as during the trip itself. Nick kept hoping that someone would find a way of stimulating imagery that didn't involve drugs. On the other hand, as he learned more about people with imagery, he was less inclined to envy them. At first, he had thought that having imagery would be like having a VCR, being able to play home movies whenever you felt wistful. But reading more about it, he had learned that memories and images could break in on you, unbidden and uncontrollable, and not necessarily happy ones. Even if the imagery wasn't frightening, it would surely be a distraction. He had come to value the dark and quiet of his mind. Nick knew that whenever Zeman talked about aphantasia, he was at pains to emphasize that it was not a disorder or even a bad thing. It was best described as an interesting variant in human experience, like synesthesia. Nick appreciated this about Zeman and reckoned that it was probably the right thing to say, but he thought that, though aphantasia itself might be neutral, the memory loss that came with it was definitely a bad thing. Many others felt the same. At one point, Zeman had been contacted by an automotive engineer from Essex named Alan Kendall, who had realized that he was aphantasic while listening to a radio segment about the condition. This revelation affected him so strongly that he put together a book of interviews with aphantasics, identified just by their initials, to help others navigate the discovery. Some people he interviewed were unbothered. There was definitely a range of responses, but others saw it as a curse. Many could remember very little about their lives, and even with the events they did remember, they could not muster the feeling of what they'd been like. They knew that some things had made them happy and others had made them sad, but that knowledge was factual. It didn't evoke any emotions in the present. ML, it leaves me as an outsider, as a viewer of life, not particularly a participant. I don't like holidays or sightseeing. What is the point? You go, you see things, you leave, and it is gone. Not a trace or a sensation remains. The advantage of a bad memory was that aphantasics seemed to suffer less from regret or shame or resentment. L. I can easily move on, forget, not hold grudges, no living in the past, and no dreaming of the future. This is it. I can live in the now. SC. I work for the emergency services, and I've spoken with my workmates about what they think the hardest part of the job is. They all said it is definitely reliving traumatic things they have seen. It is for this reason that I am glad I can't visualize. When I go home, after having someone die in front of me, I go to bed, close my eyes, and see nothing but black for a minute. Then I'm off in my dream world. But this supposed advantage was just the silver lining of something pretty dark. When aphantasics recovered from bereavement or breakups or trauma more quickly than others, they worried that they were overly detached or emotionally deficient. When they didn't see people regularly, even family, they tended not to think about them. ML. I do not miss people when they are not there. My children and grandchildren are dear to me, in a muffled way. I am fiercely protective of them, but am not bothered if they don't visit or call. I think that leaves them feeling as if I don't love them at all. I do, but only when they are with me. When they go away, they really cease to exist, except as a story. One of Kendall's interviewees was Melinda Utal, a hypnotherapist and a freelance writer from California. She had trouble recognizing people, including people she knew pretty well, so she tended to avoid social situations where she might hurt someone's feelings. When she first discovered that she was aphantasic, she called her father, who was in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease and living in a nursing home in Oregon. He had been a musician in big bands. He had toured with Bob Hope and played with Les Brown and his Band of Renown. She asked him whether he could imagine a scene in his head, and he said, "Of course. I can imagine going into a concert hall. I see the wood on the walls. I see the seats. I know I'm going to sit at the back because that's where you get the best sound. I can see the orchestra playing a symphony. I can hear all the different instruments. And I can stop it and go backward to wherever I want it to start up and hear it again." She explained to her father what aphantasia was, how she couldn't see images in her mind or hear music either. On the phone, her father started to cry. He said, "But Melinda, that's what makes us human." Melinda had an extremely bad memory for her life, even for an aphantasic. She once had herself checked for dementia, but the doctor found nothing wrong. She had become aware when she was in second grade that she had a bad memory after a friend pointed it out. In an effort to hold on to her memories, she started keeping a journal in elementary school, recording what she did almost every single day, and continued this practice for decades. When, in her 60s, she got divorced and moved into an apartment by herself, she thought it would be a good time to look through her journals and revisit her younger days. She opened one and began to sob, because to her horror, the words she had written meant nothing to her. The journals were useless. She read about things she had done, and it was as though they had happened to someone else. It was not just the distant past that she had lost. She was continuously aware of the present slipping away as soon as it had happened. She had already forgotten what her two sons had been like when they were little, the feeling of holding them. It's like, this is who they are. They were never anybody else. And that's like a knife in my chest. Now her greatest fear was that if she hadn't seen her sons in a while, she might forget them altogether. I have had to accept that my life is like water flowing through my fingers. It's just experiences moving through my hand that I can't hold on to. Although Nick had made his peace with his lack of imagery, he still grieved his inability to revisit his past. At one point, he came across the work of a Canadian psychologist, Endel Toulving, who in the early 1970s proposed that memory was not a single thing, but two distinct systems: semantic memory, which consisted of general knowledge about the world, and episodic memory, recollection of experiences from your own life. Episodic memory, the sense of reliving the past, was, Toulving believed, unique to humans, and among the most astonishing products of evolution. This, Nick realized, was what he didn't have. Learning that he lacked a profound human ability, one that he had to assume regenerated and immeasurably deepened your connection to your past life and the people in it who were now gone, including yourself as a child, well, there was nothing good about it. He would have preferred not to know. He wrote to Toulving, who told him about a study to be conducted by Brian Levine, the Baycrest neuropsychologist, who had been a colleague of his in Toronto. The study would investigate exceptionally poor autobiographical memory in healthy adults, people who did not have amnesia or dementia or brain injury or psychological trauma. Levine later named this syndrome severely deficient autobiographical memory, or SDAM. Nick was accepted as a participant and traveled to Toronto. The study found that the participants' experience of SDAM could be objectively corroborated using a variety of methods by comparing them to a control group. fMRI, for instance, showed reduced activation in the midline regions of their brains, an area normally associated with mental time travel. Nick was surprised to hear that another participant in the study had described an even starker experience of episodic memory loss than his. She felt so detached from her past that the facts she knew about it felt to her no more personal than facts about someone else. He definitely didn't feel that way. The things he knew about his life felt more personal to him than facts he knew about physics, say, even though he couldn't inhabit them in the way that other people could. He realized that Toulving's binary schema, which categorized all memory as either episodic or semantic, was too simple. His own memories were somewhere in between. He remembered that on the day that his mother died in 2003, his sister had phoned him to say that their mother was being admitted to the hospital. He had taken a train from Cambridge to London, and he had phoned an old friend to meet him in London because he was worried that, in his distress, he might go to the wrong station and miss the second train he needed to catch. But the friend helped him, and he got on the right train. And it was around Guy Fawkes Night, fireworks going off outside the train window. And then he got to the hospital and was there for a while, and then his mother died. He knew these things, and the idea of his mother dying aroused emotion in him. But he couldn't feel what it had been like to be in the train or the hospital, and he could not remember his mother's face. From an evolutionary point of view, he supposed, he had all the memory he needed. enough to know what and whom he had loved and what he should try to avoid doing again. But to think about it that way was to miss what was most important, not the function of episodic memory, but the experience of it. As he absorbed what it meant to lack episodic memory, he started wondering whether there were ways he could simulate it. He was attracted to the idea of video life-logging with wearable cameras. The footage would be a decent substitute for mental time travel. His childhood and early adulthood were lost to him, but if he started filming now, he would be able to relive at least the last decade or two of his life. On a trip to Pasadena, he went to the Apple store and tried on a virtual reality headset. This, he thought, must be what episodic memory is like. He knew it would probably be a long time before people accepted such technologies, but perhaps one day wearable cameras would be recognized as prosthetics for people with SDAM, no more remarkable than glasses. Then again, film would be very different from memory. Like memory, it would be partial, but unlike memory, it would be accurate. This, he suspected, might not necessarily be a good thing. There was something to be said for a degree of blurriness and uncertainty in recalling the past. It was helpful in forgiving other people and yourself. At some point, Nick became interested in the ideas of a British philosopher, Galen Strawson, who claimed to have no sense of himself as a continuously evolving being, a creature whose self consisted of a coherent story about accumulating memories and distinctive traits. Strawson was, for that reason, uninterested in his past. He acknowledged that his life had shaped him, but he believed that whether or not he consciously remembered it didn't matter to who he was now, any more than it mattered whether a musician playing a piece could call to mind a memory of each time he'd practiced. What mattered was how well he played. What was important, Strawson felt, was his life in the present. He liked to quote the 3rd Earl of Shaftesbury, a British philosopher of the late 17th and early 18th centuries, who had felt the same way. The metaphysicians affirm that if memory be taken away, the self is lost. But what matter for memory? What have I to do with that part? If, whilst I am but as I should be, what do I care more? Nick wasn't sure he agreed with Strawson, and he certainly didn't feel, as Strawson did, that his memory of his own life was unimportant. But he found the argument somewhat comforting. He still longed to relive important moments in his life, but it was easier to think about this experience as just one of many he hadn't had, like paragliding or visiting Peru, than as a void at the core of his self. Many people believed that their selves were made up largely of memories, and that the loss of those memories would be a self-ending catastrophe. But he knew now that there were also thousands of people like him who had work and marriages and ideas and thwarted desires and good days and bad days and the rest of it. All they lacked was a past. That was Phantasma, written by Larissa McFarquhar for The New Yorker, produced by Apple News.